Welcome to Word Balloon, the counterculture conversation show. This is John Sundress. As an artist, Joe Quesada captured fans' imagination with his work on the Ray, Azrael, and Batman for DC Comics. He and Jimmy Palmiotti started the Event Comics Company and brought their editorial sensibilities to Marvel, taking over several low-selling titles under the Marvel Knights imprint. Marvel Knights brought new energy and success to the former House of Ideas, and Quesada was tapped to take over as editor-in-chief of the whole company. Today, a conversation with Marvel Editor-in-Chief Joe Quesada, looking back and to the future of Marvel Comics.
It's almost a shame to talk to you because you're like so well-chronicled in Newsarama every week.
Yeah, but people very rarely get to hear my dulcet tones.
That's true. They did get to see you on the Colbert Report.
That's true.
And, you know, what is the, if we could just jump in, what has the mainstream media reaction been to Civil War and what Marvel is currently doing?
Well, it's really been outstanding, and it's something that I like to say we were surprised by it, but with the concept behind Civil War, we knew we were really onto something, and we knew that if we got this out to the mainstream, it would catch on like wildfire and bring a lot of new readers into comic shops, and thank God that worked. So it's been really a phenomenal reception to Civil War.
The story is back on schedule, and you did have a little problem in the late summer where you made the announcement. Do you think that affected any of that mainstream traffic? Are you hearing from dealers in terms of?
You know, it was definitely a fear, but so far we're hearing nothing again but positive remarks on it. Sales are still going up, and actually that downtime turned out to be a boon to retailers because they sold a lot of stuff that may have been sitting on the shelves and didn't have a good enough incubation period because, you know, Civil War is like so selling so fast and furious, but there are some books that may have been forgotten, so it's been helping a lot of the ancillary titles.
I wonder if, and I understand how Planet Hulk will dovetail into Civil War, mm-hmm. but scheduling Annihilation and Civil War and Planet Hulk, in addition to the crosstown competition with mainstream events, is it too much product in terms of, you know, maybe gaining the biggest possible audience?
Well, you know, it's definitely a fear that there might be too much product out there. But what we've been looking and noticing is the fact that it's all selling really, really well, and sales are increasing across the board. So while I think there is a lot of product and there is a lot of demand on our consumers' dollars, they seem to be responding really well to it. And again, I think that has a lot to do with the product that's out there. It's one thing to have a lot of product. It's another thing to have a lot of really crappy product. I'm very, very serious about
this.
Remember the great crash of the 90s. Part of the reason was that yes, we had a lot of speculators that left the industry, but also we really weren't putting out that many good comics. It was a lot of sizzle and no steak, a lot of great-looking artwork, very little story to hang your hat on. And I think what happens at that point is, yes, you lose speculators, but we lost a lot of readers, too. I maybe didn't realize how many readers we actually had lost because there were so many speculators that were taking up the slack.
You really started that trend to bring readers back with quality writing when you and Jimmy Palmiotti took over Marvel Knights.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're running the whole company. Is there a bigger difference other than more characters, more books, as far as your editorial philosophy from jumping from Marvel Knights to full-blown Marvel?
No, the philosophy was exactly the same. The biggest difference is just that there's a little more responsibility. But also with that responsibility comes the ability to do a lot more. So there were things that Jimmy and I, you know, wanted to do with Marvel Knights and said, boy, but, you know, let's pitch this to Marvel. But we didn't have the kind of clout to make it happen. We were also sort of the new guys in the office, and, mm-hmm. you know, we were looked at with a cautious eye, to say the least. but now I'm in a position where I'm able to implement those kinds of ideas, and also I'm constantly remain open to other people's ideas with respect to, like, you know, how to expand the business and how to make the books better.
Are you finding, because it's funny, in the first wave, it seems, of new writers that were coming in, there were TV and Hollywood writers, and also now recently we're seeing more novelists coming in with Charlie Houston, and I know the other guy that's taking over the Zombie Max book is another novelist, am I correct?
Yes, we have a large number of novelists that are coming by and working here at Marvel, but we also have a lot of TV people that are coming in.
Sure.
It's a great time to be a reader of comics, a lover of comics, a lover of the hobby, because, again, the quality of the writing, there was a time, again, going back 15 years, where there were two, three, four really standout writers. And now, I think it was Kevin Smith who once said, you know, throw a stone and you'll hit a brilliant writer in comics. we're very, very lucky to have this kind of quality of people creating stories for us, especially here at Marvel. So, and again, I think it also speaks to what comics have to offer writers in general, because at the end of the day, if you're writing for TV, if you're writing novels, you can make more money doing those things. And, you know, comics still does not offer that kind of a revenue boon for a lot of these
sure.
people. But there is a certain purity of vision. There's a certain singularity of voice that comics does offer a writer. You know, you could write a screenplay, and by the time that screenplay makes it to the big screen, six or seven other people have been, you know, rewriting you and rewriting
yes.
you and changing characters and motivations. And by the time it hits the screen, it's not even anything closely resembling what you created. Sometimes your name may not even be on it anymore. You have a paycheck, but no credit and no real story that belongs to you. So in comics, not true. In comics, you know, there is that purity of vision. There is that you write that story, and very rarely does editorial interfere with your story and say, no, we don't want to do that, or no, we're not going to let you do that.
Now, that is a big change from the era that you just described as well, the 15 years ago era. And it was you were working artists back then.
Yeah.
Were there editors that you can look back at that you worked under that you know you found a level of philosophy that you use today that you can name?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Archie Goodwin was an editor just like that, as was Denny O'Neill. I had the pleasure of working with both those gentlemen, and they were wonderful to me as an artist. So you know they were definitely the kind of guys that I looked up to, and in case of Denny, still look up to. But at the end of the day, I came to my editorial job as to Jimmy when we started from the freelancer point of view. You know, now we've worked both sides of the desk, and we know exactly how we wanted to be treated as a freelancer and how we expect to treat freelancers when they come through our door.
How about writing tips, Joe? You know, the few times that you have, you know, come in with stories from Marvel, they have been exceptional. I really loved the Iron Man and the Iron Mask. I thought that was really one of the best Iron Man stories in a long time. And I know you're wrapping up Daredevil Father.
Yeah, trust me, the ending's really good. It's coming.
Well, you've certainly, you know, put your stamp on the character. I'm one of those guys waiting for the trade. No offense.
That's not a problem.
But I saw what happened with NYX in terms of scheduling. And you do have a lot on your plate. You are a busy guy. First let's talk about, you know, what did you learn from guys like Goodwin and O'Neill or other writers in terms of your own writing?
Well, I think a couple of very important things. I learned a lot about character, but I also learned that, you know, you shouldn't start a story unless you really know exactly where it's going to end. I see a lot of writers come up, and even professionals still working today that start a story and don't necessarily know exactly where the ending of their story is. If you know the beginning of your story and the end of your story, the actual middle is the easiest part of a story to figure out. So you'll see that I'll embark on the occasional story here and there. The only time I'll do that is if I have a story that definitely has an ending. I don't think I'm ever going to be a guy who can write a monthly comic for 2, 3, 4 years.
You sure.
know, when I'm done here being editor-in-chief. I don't know. Maybe that'll change. But as when it comes to writing assignments, when I had the idea for Mask and the Iron Man, and when I had the idea for NYX and the idea for Daredevil Father, I had the endings. That's exactly how the idea started. It started
okay.
with an ending, a place I wanted to get to with the characters, a great reveal, something that we've never seen before, and then thought to myself, okay, now I can build the story around this. If I don't have that, I just don't write.
Now, stemming from that, what is your editorial philosophy when you look at things like the long run of one writer and one artist? We're seeing Bagley and Bendis,
right.
the team wrap up on Ultimate Spider-Man. Bendis is staying on. The case of Straczynski.
We've been trying to get rid of him for years. Bagley's been carrying him, and unfortunately we're losing the wrong guy.
And on Amazing, of course, Straczynski's been on for a couple years now. So actually,
yes.
several.
Yeah.
Wow, we're going on 5 years now with Straczynski.
I think a little more than 5 years, yeah.
Because September 11th, of course. Yeah, I certainly know he came on right before September 11th.
Yeah.
So what is your feeling on that versus the, wow, look who's on the book for this set of 6 months or a year?
Right. Again, you know, there are certain guys that do that kind of stuff really, really well, and Brian and Joe are exceptional at keeping the plate spinning month in and month out. And they've been doing a great job of it. You know, again, everybody operates at a different level. A guy like Mark Millar, Mark prefers to do like a year on a book,
mm-hmm.
and then he feels like, you know, he's got his year in, he had told his story, he wants to move on to the next project. Every project and every writer and every artist are completely different, and you just try to manage your books towards that. You know, there's no right or wrong way, the way I see it. Obviously, yeah, putting on a superstar guy like a Joss Whedon on Runaways for four issues, five issues, whatever it may be, is going to be an exceptional boon to that book, and it's going to really, you know, bring sales to a level that we never thought we'd see on Runaways. So we'll take them as they come. But again, my philosophy is basically just that, really, take it as it comes.
For Civil War, this obviously has to have gone beyond your expectations in terms of where the story will go beyond the event.
Mm-hmm.
Is that fair to say? I mean, are you guys just, you know, wow, we didn't even think that, you know, X is even coming up. We're still working on, you know, U, V, and W as far as story points, and, you know, there's great things coming up that, you know, you guys haven't even touched yet.
Yeah, I mean, we're editorially speaking, creatively speaking, we're beyond Civil War, right? We know where we are late next year. And I'll be honest with you, I am more excited about the post-Civil War Marvel U than I am about Civil War as it's happening right now, because I know where it all ends up, and I know where our books go from this point. And I'm seeing, you know, World War Hulk in the horizon, and a couple of other things that we have planned, which are really going to be a lot of fun. And I think, again, I think Marvel readers, it's a great time to be a Marvel reader. We're really going to do some great stuff that I think they're going to enjoy it, they're going to hate it, and they're going to love it, and they're going to hate it, and they're going to love it, and enjoy it again.
It is that tug of war that I'm curious about, because you're really serving two audiences, because there is the audience, I think, that does get excited and welcomes every new idea. Mm-hmm. And then there is the hardcore fan. It seems like on the one hand, it's a soap opera, and on the other hand, each story should be its own event, and you do want to shake things up and really put the characters through the paces. And it seems sometimes that the soap opera fans take real exception to some of the twists and turns in a story, be it from a character standpoint or, you know, direct events that happen within a given story.
Well, they do in the beginning. They always do in the beginning, because change is a scary thing for some people. It just is. But the truth of the matter is that when you, if you were to ask one of these fans who really likes the soap opera and likes the status quo, and you say, what were your favorite storylines in comics in general? Not just Marvel, any company, Indies, DC, whatever it may be. And they will cite their favorite stories. And I guarantee you, the one thing that every single one of those stories has is a huge change in the character's status quo.
Mm-hmm.
Name a great storyline. Name a great Marvel, DC storyline. It doesn't matter. They're great because there is change that is effective upon the characters and the story and their universe, and things change. Now, what happens is that after things change, a year down the road, 2 years down the road, they become the status quo. And we don't want them to change again until the next big change happens. And then that becomes status quo 2 or 3 years. So, you know, it was very funny. I was just talking to somebody today about, they said, hey, did you know that there's a toy out of the Iron Spider design that you did? I said, oh, that's kind of cool. It's nice. And then I started telling a story. I was like, you know, out of all the things I've done here at Marvel, I have never gotten more hate mail about that redesign of the Spider-Man costume. Even when I just said, hey, listen, guys, it's only for a few months. It's just a redesign because it serves the story. The hate mail was through the roof.
Sure.
And then at a convention, an artist who had been at Marvel many, many years ago pulled me aside and said, hey, listen, I've seen the flack you're getting over the Iron Spider thing. I'm like, yeah, you know, it's what fans do. He said,
sure.
You know that Marvel got a tremendous amount of hate mail over the black costume. I'm like, yeah, that kind of figures.
Exactly.
You know? And now people can't wait for the black costume.
Right, and you announced that it's coming up.
Yeah, and it's just going to be in the movie, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, there will be a time, you know, 10 years from now, 15 years from now, where somebody, some other editor-in-chief, will use the Iron Spider costume. People go, oh, it's so cool, I love that thing. And we'll forget all about the hate.
Well, and I guess the real trick is knowing when the gimmick, for lack of better description, wears off, and as you say, it's time to change the status quo again,
yep.
As opposed to staying in place with a status quo that, you know, the audience does reject, and sales do drop. You know,
yep.
I always find it interesting that the people that take such exception with those changes don't realize how indestructible these characters are at the end of the day.
Well, they they are somewhat indestructible. There are things you can do that do hurt a character. You know, I've gone on ad nauseum about you know, Spider-Man Wedding, how while it may not seem on the surface that it really hurt the Spider-Man character, it really has. I mean, talk to any writer who's worked on Spider-Man, and they will tell you that they're just – It's taken a real toll on the character and the kind of stories that we can tell.
Sure.
And it takes Peter out of certain situations. So there are things that you can do that do damage a character and do handcuff a character, and you want to try to avoid those things. But the characters are very, very resilient. And again, when you look at books that sort of die on the vine, that a successful book that's not doing well anymore, it's usually because there isn't a change to the status quo or a fear to change the status quo. Now, I'm not saying that you should just do it willy-nilly, because then that defeats the whole purpose. But you should always think about stories that shake up your characters. The characters are meant to be thrown against the wall. They're meant to be broken so you can put them back together again. And a character like Peter Parker epitomizes that, absolutely epitomizes the idea of taking a character and breaking it, only to put it back together again. Or sometimes, in the case of what was happening with Peter before Civil War, you give a character everything it wants. You build the character to the point where he's almost irrecognizable because of the fact that you know, he's not the ordinary. Here's Peter Parker. Not only is he married to a supermodel, but he lives in a luxury apartment in New York City in a high rise, and he's working for Tony Stark, and everything's great, and Aunt May is getting a little on the side.
You know, Jarvis, yes.
How good can life be? Life is as good as it gets. And sometimes you take characters to the opposite extreme just so you can pull the plug and see what happens again. So, you know, yes, there is a resilience to the character, but you do have to be careful at the same time.
Well, and if things really do blow up, like before your time with the Clone Saga, you just tear it up, you forget about it, and it's like, okay, like you just make the statement, it's not in canon. I noticed in one of your Newsarama, Joe Fridays, you were talking about the Rawhide Kid and the entry in the Marvel Universe.
Right.
And yeah, you're like, look, it's not in canon itself. Calm down.
No, actually, I said the opposite. I said it is canon.
Rawhide Kid is now canon. Excuse me.
Yeah. What had happened was that it was a whole mishap with the entry to the handbook, and I was really kind of upset about it. But hey, you know what? We're a big publishing company. There's a lot of people working on a lot of things, and mistakes happen all the time. So it's just one of those things.
Let's take a few examples of recent revamps that worked and didn't work. I love the first issue of Doctor Strange with Brian Vaughn. And who's doing the art, by the way?
Is it Marcos Martin, I believe is his last name?
Moon Knight with Charlie Houston and Dave...
Dave Finch.
Thank you, Dave Finch. I was going to say Dave Lynch, but of course that's...
That's
a racer head, exactly. Omega Flight with Oeming and Collins. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I want to point at one that didn't work, and that's Greg Pak's Warlock.
Right.
So what is the process that goes into deciding whether a property needs to be either reimagined or returning to its essence in the case of, like, Doctor Strange, for example, in Moon Knight?
Well, you know, first of all, let me say in defense of Greg Pak's Warlock. Greg got a little shortchanged by us on that because it's too long a story to get into, but Warlock should have been and had more time than it did.
Okay.
And it was just there was an editorial sort of process that we were going through, and we kind of handcuffed Greg on that one.
Okay.
And I sort of knew it was coming, but it happened, and you know, we'll move on, and hey, Greg is better for it.
I think he's doing just fine now with Planet Hulk.
He's succeeded quite well despite Warlock, Now, what was the question again?
Well, just what goes into the process of deciding whether a property needs to either be changed or back to its essence?
You know, it's just something that if you're in publishing enough and if you're doing your job right, you kind of just feel it in your gut. Somebody on a website, I think, quoted Mike Carlin as saying, sometimes a character is radioactive. That's a great way of putting it. Sometimes... You know, and by the way, that's also why you have to be careful when you do relaunch a character that you do the best you can, because let's say this Warlock relaunch had been a failure. Moon Knight.
Sure.
If Moon Knight launch had been a failure, well, you basically can count on Moon Knight not having another series probably for another 3 years. It's usually a good 3+ years before a character becomes unradioactive again. That's what happens when you have a bad relaunch of a character. So we try to be careful, and you just have to sort of feel it in your gut and say, you know what, we haven't seen this character in a while. Maybe it's time to revamp them and bring them back. And that was certainly in the air when it came to that. We could all sense it. I think Wizard Magazine was doing articles on, boy, we'd like to see Moon Knight back. And we knew the time was right. We just didn't have the right story. So while the timing was right, we said, you know what, let's wait. It's not like, you know, it's going to go away. It's not like the sense that we need Moon Knight is going to go away. So let's just wait till the right writer comes along. And here comes Charlie Houston, and boy, does he knock it out of the park.
Yeah, I'm a big fan.
Yeah.
Well, now
and David Finch, by the way, who is an absolute genius.
Yeah, it's a beautiful book. Well, now conversely, Doctor Strange, you know, before the current story that's going on with Brian,
right.
You had Straczynski kind of retell the origin with Brandon Peterson.
Yeah.
And beautiful book, different ideas, didn't seem to really catch on because we're back to the essence of the Ditko Lee Doctor Strange.
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind, the JMS Doctor Strange was a screenplay that Joe had actually written for the Doctor Strange movie.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah,
that's interesting.
Which they ended up not making a Doctor Strange movie at that time. But we had the screenplay, and I basically asked Joe, Joe, can you just adapt this to a comic? And sure. So that's kind of what we did.
Okay.
So, you know, I thought it was just a cool way to repurpose a story that Joe had already worked out.
Sure.
And yet now we have, you know, Brian Vaughn and Marcus Martin doing this sort of a little bit more of a retro kind of feel to Doctor Strange. Again, you know, that's the beauty of comic characters in general, is the fact that you can do so many different incarnations of them and still have them all be successful at one point or another.
Tell me about Omega Flight. I talked to Oming about it.
Right.
And I think that's interesting because, you know, I know Canadian fans particularly were really, you know, wanting the Alpha Flight team back.
Right.
It's coming back, but it's not quite the Alpha Team Flight.
Yeah,
it is a different story.
Let's see what happens. Look, there is sometimes books that don't sell very, very well have an incredibly vibrant and vocal audience. and if you're not careful, it could fool you into thinking, hey, you know, Speedball Chef is ongoing. That's going to do great. I got thousands of emails from Speedball fans. And then you sell like two copies. You're like, hey, what happened to all those people? Where'd they go? They said they love Speedball. They said they'd support anything he did or any book he was in. So you have to be a little bit careful about that. The idea for Omega Flight, I think, is very, very cool. And I think fans of the old Alpha Flight are going to dig it. So let's see what happens.
You mentioned Speedball, and I got to acknowledge how great Jenkins' frontline has been.
Isn't it great?
And it's great from literally three different levels when you look at the book and realize that you're getting three stories.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, you know, you're putting Speedball through hell, but that's made him more interesting than he's ever been.
Yeah, and, you know, the funny thing about Speedball is that Speedball internally, not just online, but internally, Speedball has always been the brunt of all my jokes. You know, like, I always use Speedball as an example whenever we have a conversation about low-selling comics or characters with funny names. You know, it's like I just see Mothers of America embracing. You know, let's just name a character Cocaine. You know, why not? I'm sure that'll do well. And so he's always sort of been like the brunt of a lot of jokes here at Marvel. I remember once saying, you know, I got to do something right by this character because I've been so cruel to the character. And then as we started working out the ideas for Civil War and some interesting opportunities arose for Speedball, I was like, this is a time for this character to shine. We could actually do something with this character named Speedball.
And who,
by the way, bounces. That's his power.
Yeah, that's a tough power to have in prison.
Well, yeah. Anywhere.
I also want to point out, because I really think that in the right hands, I think you're showing with a lot of the anthologies lately and with Frontline that shorter stories can have a big impact.
Yeah.
And you've got a really talented guy with Jenkins doing it in Frontline. And
yeah, Paul is doing, for my money, Paul's doing the first really great anthology. What Paul is doing in Frontline is so exceptional because as you said, you know, and first of all, anthologies are a very, very tough sell. They're a very, very tough sell. And I think the last anthology that I really enjoyed was the anthologies, the ABC anthology by Alan Moore.
Oh, Tomorrow Stories, sure.
Tomorrow Stories. So I think Paul is probably the first guy to really, really do an anthology in all his time since Alan. That for me, at least, I just find it incredibly entertaining. I love reading my advanced copies of Frontline, and especially what's happening to poor old Speedball. It really is tragic.
Well, and it sounds like you're further expanding or experimenting with the anthology with Marvel Comics Presents.
Yes.
And now that's going to be 3 8-inch.
I know, 20 we say experimenting, but we're just bringing back stuff.
Well, but okay.
What is old is new again.
Well, and you know, I remember one of my favorite anthology books, and it was short-lived for Marvel Knights, was Double Shot.
Right.
Because they were really interesting short stories.
Yeah.
And I tell Gene Ha every time I see him, he's a Chicago guy. And I'm like, dude, I'm telling you, your Iron Fist story, that was just a lot of fun. And it was just this gorgeous little, 12-page story.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite stories to do was the Punisher dentist story with Garth Ennis.
But again, a story in the right hands, and I mean, certainly Garth's the right guy. I'm looking forward to Fraction doing War Journal, and I think he is a great addition to Marvel because he is such a crazy guy, and I'm loving everything that he does from Image and all the other companies
cool.
as well. But Garth really does have that definitive Punisher voice.
Absolutely, and I think Matt's going to do a great job on the book. I mean, what I've read so far is really, really great. And again, it's also two very different feels. On each one of these books, the Fraction book is a little more superheroes centric, Marvel Universe centric, and Garth is basically writing the R-rated Punisher movie,
mm-hmm.
and you don't really expect superheroes to pop up in his book.
No, it's nice, it's great though because Joe, one of my favorite periods in Marvel was that 70s to early 80s period when the black and white magazines told really interesting stories and great artists as well.
Yeah.
And just that great grayscale of seeing, the Hulk and Shang-Chi and, all the monsters and stuff. And it's nice to see that, there is more expansion in the Max line, in the Icon books, and kind of trying to get that adult audience and finding the right titles and formats to serve that audience.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad to see you guys are doing it.
Thank you. I'm just agreeing with you.
All right, that's fine. See, because I said
a compliment me, I'm going to take it.
I said a nice thing, exactly. I also wanted to ask about the What If books. They seem to all be tied around events.
Yeah, it's we've had quite a number of sort of modern day events, significant modern day events that we felt, well, here's an idea for What If. Why don't we tie it around the modern day events and see what happens? So I think the ideas are really sound very, very cool. So excited to see those books come out.
Very cool. And I'll tell you, I'm a huge fan of Agents of Atlas. I think big Jeff Parker fan. And also, I wanted to ask about the Western anthologies, the monster anthologies from last year.
Right.
How much of that is, we haven't done anything with these characters for a while, let's see what sticks, versus a crass business trademark issue of, hey, if we don't put out a book that's called Rawhide Kid, we're going to lose the title.
Yeah, every once in a while you do have to do something like that. You have to do it for the branding and licensing, and trademarks. But these particular incarnations that have come out, one of our newest senior editors, Mark Paniche, Mark just loves that stuff, and his sensibilities. He's got a little bit more of the quirkier sensibility in our editorial group. So books like Agents of Atlas and the whole Western Month and Western Month and Monster Month, that all came out of his office and his brain.
That's cool.
He's just a very strange man, but he loves that stuff. And again, I think it's great that we have a guy with Mark's talents here that actually looks at some of the stuff that no other editor would. Another editor would look at it and go, oh, man, I don't know if I could do the Western stuff. But Mark looks at it and goes, I love this stuff. And he just goes crazy and finds the right creators. And even his sensibility in creators is a little bit off the beaten path. So not only are we seeing a lot of characters that we haven't seen in quite some time and concepts that we haven't seen in quite some time, but we're also seeing artists who may not have worked at Marvel in the past. I mean, look, Mark brought back Death's Head, okay? So that gives you an idea of the kind of stuff he's into.
A lot of people characterize Marvel as really just sticking to the mainstream 616 universe and the Ultimate Universe, and that there isn't room for this kind of experimentation. I liked a couple books that I bet flew under the radar and probably weren't big sellers, but I thought they were distinct ideas. One was Underworld, the Frank Tyrion story. Now, was that from Mark's office as well?
No, that was in Axel Alonso's office.
Okay. And I was wondering, is there room for Mark's ideas and Axel's ideas? Axel's ideas are very different. We had a conversation at the beginning of the year, and a lot of his stuff, despite, serving as a mainstream editor for some of your big titles,
right.
like obviously now taking care of the X-Books and stuff, there's enough room for wild-haired projects and stories like that? Because, Sable and Fortune, I thought that was a beautiful, very interesting idea, and was disappointed that there was the artist change at the end. I'm assuming, and tell me if I'm wrong, that it was a combination of low sales and let's just get it out and finish it for the people that did stick around for the story.
Yeah, a little bit of both, but also for people that are still saying that Marvel doesn't do anything but superhero books, You know, I think that's just something people like saying now for the sake of saying it, because when you do look at what we're doing, all right, we've already talked about Mark Paniche's books and, mm-hmm. and, you know, the Westerns and the monster books. You have to look at the Max line now that we're actually in the process of producing more Max material. Then, of course, there is the Ultimate line. Then, of course, there is the regular Marvel Universe. Then there's the Marvel Adventure books. Then there are books like Mary Jane Loves Spider-Man. Then there are the upcoming Davil Brother books, which should hit the stands within the next month, I guess, or a couple of months. And then there is the recently announced Marvel Illustrated line, which is going to take classic material and adapt it into comic book form. There's so much stuff going down. And then there's the Icon line. I'm sorry, I forgot the Icon line.
There you go.
So I don't know what bases we're missing at this point, to be honest with you. You know, that,
sure.
granted, a lot of these lines are just starting up, but it's not, you know, people want things to happen instantaneously. And just if you do stuff too quickly, if you just say, hey, you know what, we're going to do 12 classic books and just get them off the ground, you're doomed for failure because you have to build the imprint, you have to build the line, and we're trying to be smart about it. So all these things happen, you know, slowly, but they're happening. And you know, that old saying that Marvel's only doing superhero stuff, don't buy it anymore.
Okay. There, we've been talking about what goes inside the box, and let's talk about the box itself. And these might be more Dan Buckley questions, but I just want to get your feeling on it. Are we hitting the ceiling with the $3 comic? Is there room for a monthly price point to get more expensive? It seems to me, as a consumer, as much as I enjoy it, I do kind of wince when my weekly bill exceeds like $30, and you know, that's 10 bucks, you know.
You know, listen, I hear you, and it's just it's the economies of scale and of life in general. Dan could probably talk more about that. The only thing that I find humorous is sometimes when one of my ancient editors pulls me aside here and says, "Hey, take a look at this letters page, or take a look at this letter that Stan received, and it's a letter from somebody saying 25 cents for a comic. I'm done. I can't afford this. How do you expect a kid to buy a comic at 25 cents, for crying out loud?" So, you know, I'm not making light of the fact that comics are expensive.
I understand.
They are expensive, but man, so is everything else out there right now. I mean, I don't know. You know, pound for pound, entertainment dollar for entertainment dollar, is there anything out there that's a dollar?
No, and I understand that.
Yeah.
I completely agree, but it does affect, from a creative standpoint, how a story is told.
Okay, what sense?
Well, I would think that, you know, this goes back to waiting for the trade versus getting the monthly and getting the fix.
Uh-huh.
And certainly the end market might be the one that certainly withstands the test of time. It will be the trades that get circulated and have the opportunity to go back to press. But you tell me, I mean, there are times in the six-part story, the right writer has the book and is able to make each issue matter, and you feel like you've really gotten a full treatment. There are times when that isn't the case, and you know that it's going to be part of a big trade,
right?
But you've really gotten a chapter that really is a middle chapter and doesn't, you know, resolve its own issue.
Yeah, I mean, look, there's several philosophies to this. If you go back when I started here as editor in chief, Marvel was still producing their stories, the types of stories and the structure of their stories were being produced for the newsstand business.
Mm-hmm.
And by that, I mean, and by the way, that's the same way that Stan Lee was producing it back in his day.
You bet.
And by that, I mean it's here's a story. Oh, and here's a cliffhanger. Next month, here's the beginning of the cliffhanger. Here's as a result. Oh, and it ends with a cliffhanger. So it was the world of never-ending cliffhangers.
Yes.
So if you look at it from that point of view, then you're saying, hey, you know, I'm reading a lot of first and second acts, and I'm not getting any real third act resolution here. it's just a matter of how the stories are constructed. So now that we have this great world of trade paperback, we're writing our comic stories. More, I'd say it's more akin to writing for television, where you're writing or writing mini movies. You know, either way, it's still episodic, but the episodes occur in big chapters that resolve themselves. Because we do have this other world that we're selling to, which is you don't want to have a trade that ends in the cliffhanger. Sure, it's okay to have a trade that has a couple of little dangling plot lines that lead somebody to the next trade, but you want to make sure when somebody buys a trade that there is a full and satisfactory read when it's all said and done. This is very important to our business, obviously. And, you know, again, when we started our big trade business, started to hear people say, well, you know, people are going to want to buy the trade, so the monthly comics are dead. Well, here's the truth. Right now, trade sales are through the roof as monthly comic sales have been increasing. And it's something that I've been saying for years since I've been here, that there are two types of consumers. There is the hardcore habitual comic addict, the hardcore fan. This is the person that goes to their comic shop every Wednesday, stands there in front of the rack, makes their selection, goes home, reads it. Next Wednesday, they're back again.
Yep.
Every Wednesday, habitually. And if they can't be there on Wednesday, they ask their retailer to pull the books for them. And when they get there, their books will be waiting for them. But if they can get there Wednesday, they're going to get there Wednesday.
Sure.
Now, if you look at that particular buying habit, that particular, you know, purchasing habit, it's really not a very common one. Can you think of anything that you buy that you're there on a weekly basis on the same day at the same time to pick up your purchase? I really can't think of anything that I do. Now, mind you, if I was a fanatic, let's say, of a particular band, yes, when their album comes out, I will be at the record store the day the album comes out to pick up that album. But it's far from being weekly. Even grocery shopping, you know, don't go grocery shopping on the same day. You go when it's convenient. I know I have to do it, you know, once every week, 2 weeks, but never the same day. I'm not there when the eggs come out. So that particular buying habit of the hardcore comic book fan is really unusual. And what we have found, though, is that there's a second kind of customer, which is the casual hardcore addict. And by that I mean the person who, you know what, I got a family, I got kids, I got a crazy job, I travel a lot. I just cannot be at the comic shop every Wednesday. It's just way too much work, way too much of a commitment. But hey, I'm walking by a bookstore and, oh, there's Ultimate Spider-Man, Volume 3. Yeah, you know, I have number 2. Let me pick up number 3. And they may not venture by a bookstore for another month, another 2 months. And when they do, it's like, oh, hey, look, they had number 4 in. Oh, number 5 is in, too. I don't have those. Let me pick it up. So what happens is that when the product is there and when their time is made available to look for the product, whether it be casually or a special trip to the bookstore or if they get the trade paperbacks, when it's there, they buy it because they are habitually addicted to our stuff, but not enough that they have to make a special trip. So it is an interesting world we live in. And then, of course, there's also a portion of the hardcore weekly fan who likes to have it in single issues and the trade when
sure.
it comes out.
Insane. Yeah. And a lot of disposable income, those people, but good well, fortune you know, to them.
Look, if those of us that have disposable income and do like to spend it on entertainment, our entertainment dollars are being spread. There's a lot of demand on the entertainment dollars.
Absolutely.
And they can get spread thin. So ultimately, the way that comics survive in this world is by providing great content. For years and years and years, people were saying, it's really funny, people always use video games as the scapegoat, as the
yes.
excuse why their entertainment product is not doing well. Oh, nobody's watching TV, kids are playing video games. Oh, no, that's because you're not putting any good TV shows on the air.
Yep.
Put some good TV shows on the air, and people will stop everything they're doing, and they'll watch it. Kids don't read anymore. Kids don't want to read. All they care about is playing those stupid video games. Yeah, well, here comes this little thing called Harry Potter, and kids will throw their video games in the garbage to get the next in a trade to get the next Harry Potter book if they can get it in advance.
Now you're right about that.
So, you know, and the toy business is going through a lot of this too. You know, hey, action figures don't sell anymore. Toys, it's all about video games, and I'm sitting here going, I think it's just you're waiting for the next compelling thing to happen. So it's the same thing with comics. When comics were dying on the vine here, people were saying, you know what, it's just damn video games, man. We just can't compete. They're like comics, but they move. And I'm sitting here going, you know, there's really no story. They don't offer the same thing as long as what we're doing is compelling and we're doing it right. So I think when a person is given the opportunity to immerse themselves in something like a comic or a novel or a great story, whether it be on TV, in the movies, or in printed page, versus mindlessly kind of manipulating a character on screen and just blowing stuff up, I think they're going to go for the more compelling material, the great read, the great show, the great movie. Again, Hollywood's having a hard time right now, really hard time.
Yes.
But there's nothing really compelling out there to see.
Except The Departed.
Except The Departed, right? But I'm saying, the minute that something good comes out, word spreads like wildfire.
You bet.
Like, how much money do you think the next Spider-Man movie is going to make? I don't even think anybody can count that high, all right? But we know. Already word of mouth is sizzling on the internet, in fandom,
yes,
about this particular movie. So that's all. You know, that's really our philosophy here, which is just, you know what, just make it good. As long as you keep making it good, there will always be people who will spend good money to get what you have.
With Marvel now taking over the movie end of their business and having much more of a direct impact, is there room for the comic books to have more play from a marketing standpoint? I mean, it seems like when you look at the DVDs, there's great features about, you know, the history of the character, and you've,
right,
you're on there, and all the writers and artists, and it is a nice, you know, crossover envoy to getting the Marvel books. But, you know, there always can be, you know, more done. Is it going to be easier now that you're not dealing with as many companies?
Well, you know, the movie end of it has never really infringed on anything that we've done publishing-wise. What has happened now, though, is with us producing our own movies, there is so much more synergy between what Marvel Studios is doing and what we do in publishing, and there really is a tremendous collaboration, and also the guys at Marvel Studios, they're smart enough to know, they look at the source material and say, okay, this is what works,
okay,
and this is what doesn't work, and when you have a third party that comes in, it's much harder because you sit there, and I know, you know, the guys at Marvel Studios, they sit there and say, no, I mean, you try to steer the studio into a different direction, and no, they see it this way. So there's a lot of give and take, but it's
sure,
give and take with the third and sometimes fourth parties. In this case, it's one conduit. It's Marvel doing the whole thing. And I think just by the recent announcements of all the casting, the recent casting on the Iron Man movie,
mm-hmm,
tell me that you're not feeling and saying, wow, this looks like it's a movie that's being made by people that understand the source material.
That is
a tribute to Marvel Studios and what those guys are going to be doing with this film slate. It's going to be amazing as they start making their movies out there.
Is that the first film that will be under Marvel Studios proper? Or
I believe so. I don't have the full slot in front of me, but I believe that Iron Man is going to be the inaugural, yes.
Okay. Because, yeah, I wonder, you know, with Ghost Rider coming up too,
right,
you know, how much, you know, direct involvement. And not even from a creative synergy standpoint, as you were pointing out.
Right.
But I wonder the converse. Yes, you want to satisfy the Ghost Rider fans with a good movie.
Right.
But you also want fans of the Ghost Rider movie to then come and check out the books.
No, of course. Of course.
And I'm wondering if, you know, yeah, certainly will there be more direct opportunities to really, you know, I don't even know in what form, whether it's, you know,
well,
handing out comics literally at the movie theaters,
well,
you know, something like that.
It's not even things like that, okay, because that's a whole other kettle of fish.
Okay.
But it's more stuff in the sense that if we're doing a movie with, let's say, Universal, I'm just pick any studio,
sure,
okay, Joe's Studios, and Joe's Studios is footing the bill for that movie. They're paying hard money,
oh, sure,
to get that movie done. And if they say to you, we want this movie to be out in the theaters on this particular month, but for us, it's not the best month in which to, let's say, sell toys,
uh-huh,
or sell merchandise or licensing, they don't care.
Right. Well, yeah.
You know what I mean? So now we could actually work the timing of our releases in a much more strategic fashion. So there, again, one of the things that I think is a hallmark of this new regime at Marvel has been the great synergy that we've had between comics, toys, licensing, and movies to some extent. The times that the synergy hasn't, the timing hasn't worked great is usually when a studio says, no, we need this movie to come out at this point, and it really puts everybody at DEFCON 5 because you've got to try to get stuff done by a certain schedule, and sometimes the schedule doesn't necessarily work best for the world of retail. So there's a lot of masters that have to be served here. But now, as we are sort of, you know, doing it all ourselves, I think it's just going to be really great to see. And let's face it, we know one thing for sure, and that's that Marvel movies make lots of money.
That's cool. Now, you're a musician, and I've enjoyed your parody songs that you've come out with every Christmas.
Right.
And I know that, you know, you guys mess around and really do play occasionally, am I correct, in New York and in some of the con cities or whatever?
Yep.
Well, is there ever a thought as a musician that you really do want to get back and, you know, write something and cut an album or, you know, I don't want to say a serious album, that to trivialize what you do with the parodies, because that takes work and ingenuity as well.
Yeah, you know, I've thought about it. I've had an offer by a mainstream big time producer to do something, but first of all, it takes a lot of time.
Sure.
It really, really takes a lot of time, and I sort of put the whole music life, it really was another life, and I've kind of put it behind me.
Okay.
And it's become so much more enjoyable to me now that I just do it for the fun of it. So, you know, we'll get together as a group and we'll play the occasional charity show here, and I think there's going to be a Marvel rock concert. There's a three or four bands of comprised of Marvel staff members that'll be playing, I think, in November 10th in the city here. So those kind of things, I'll always get together with the guys just for the fun of it. It's always fun just to sort of bang on a guitar for a little bit. But taking it much more seriously beyond that, nah.
Okay.
It wasn't until I was out of the music business that I realized how much I disliked the music business. I dislike music. The business of it really kind of blows.
Well, and it's changing. I mean, you know, with the internet and stuff, and the internet has affected comics too. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, almost stemming back to what I was asking about with the monthly issues. Bendis is, you know, a futurist, and he likes to read. Actually, right. I'm giving Bendis way too much credit. Bendis is a guy who likes to read what futurists have to say about the future. And let's be honest, we've discussed what the electronic book might look like. And
right.
He, you know, he's convinced, hey, you know, 10 years from now, we're going to be a paperless society. And that, I think, would be great for the comic book industry, because so much of it, I think, and maybe I'm wrong, but a lot of delays might also happen in post-production, as well as waiting for a creator to finish a script or finish some art.
Yeah.
Do you ever think about what the future may look like? Because, again, that might change the nature of what comes out in episodic fashion, as opposed to the eventual finished product of a trade.
You know, you have to constantly think about those things, and while, you know, while I don't think we're going to be a paperless society in 10 years, who knows what 30, 40 years from now brings?
Sure.
There are incredibly interesting things on the horizon, and I think the important thing is that you just have to keep yourself open to it. You have to be, if you sit here and you sort of close your eyes and say it's not going to change, it's not going to change, it's not going to change, that's kind of how you get run over by the change
truck.
You bet. So you know, it's just a matter of keeping your ear to the ground. And by the way, that's true for anybody in business. You have to be ready to embrace technology and the improvements that come within technology, rather than just sit there and say, hey, you know what, these newfangled ideas and these young kids, and, you know, you end up sounding like the crazy old man who, you know, shit chases you out of his backyard. So you know, while in no way do I you know, pretend to understand or know exactly what's coming down the pike, I will be buying a new iPod this Christmas. So
see, you should wait, because the next device is going to be.
I know,
something.
It's really crazy, right?
Yes.
It's like I keep saying, I shouldn't buy this Christmas because, you know, next year they'll be implanting it into my head, and it won't get it can't get much smaller than that.
Hey, do you, and I'm not fishing for a compliment or anything,
right.
And I know that you're in a good association with Scott Hines and Fanboy Radio.
Right.
What do you think of the podcast? What do you think?
I think it's great. I remember reading an article on podcasts 2-3 years ago, and I remember coming screaming into Marvel saying, guys, check this out. This is brewing. We need to start doing this. And consequently, we've done some here at Marvel as
yes.
well. I think they're a great form of communication. It's more of the sort of humanizing of the entertainment community. I think it's just a great way to get out there to people. Especially, I'm assuming, did you guys go through iTunes as well?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
There you go. You know, I am addicted to iTunes. I no longer buy CDs. And actually, I'm slowly but surely burning my CD collection and letting go of my plastic, vinyl, not plastic. So I'm a big advocate of this kind of stuff. And we were just talking about the music industry and how much that's changed.
Absolutely.
And how much, you know, it no longer matters that you're signed to a big label. When I was a struggling musician, I mean, you know, we were doing showcases for Capitol and you know, just you name it. I mean, it was insane.
Sure.
And it just didn't make sense to us to sign to an indie label. We were going for the big guys, and now it's just like none of that stuff matters. None of it matters. You could just have a great song, a great album, and go out there and viral market the darn thing and make some money.
That's
fantastic.
Cool. And I notice as well, not only with podcasts, but I enjoy the trailers that you guys have put together for some of your big story events as well.
Yeah,
and
believe
putting
it or not,
them on YouTube and places like that.
Yeah, believe it or not, with this is the second generation of trailers. People forget that we actually, when Bill Jemis was here, Bill was instrumental in getting trailers done. We had seen some technology. We had a guy here on staff who was really good at making them. So we actually made them for, we were talking about the John Eber and John Cassidy Captain America. We did trailers for those, and we did some trailers for Hulk and the Ultimates, and so this is actually the second generation, but they're pretty cool.
You guys really were very heavy internet intensive in that period when you and Bill took over.
Yeah.
What has changed in terms of an editorial philosophy from that time? I mean, that's a big essay question to lay on you right at the end of the interview. But I wonder. Like, I mean, can you point at things that, like, well, we did it this way, but we're not really doing it that way anymore. And I don't mean in terms of that this was Jemis's idea and he was wrong, and that and that's what I'm saying. So take Bill out of the equation.
Right. Well, one of the things that's happened over time is you learn a lot of lessons. You learn a lot of good lessons. You learn a lot of hard lessons. So taking those lessons, you try to apply them to what you do today. And by that, I'm speaking myself. You know, I mean, there are obviously things that we did that were really crazy and that worked out, and some that were crazy and just didn't work out. And some that in retrospect, that wasn't so crazy after all. So you try to take all that stuff and learn from it and not get too stubborn about it. But, you know, the one lesson that has carried over from the very, very beginning, is one in which one of the things that both Bill and I discovered as we sort of, you know, took over these positions at Marvel and started dealing with the creative community and the editorial community and fandom in general was that we were really, really surprised at how the business of comics, the business of making comics, the business of writing and drawing comics really was kind of unchanged since Stan Lee's time.
Yes.
I mean, we were just doing things. And we were doing things because, in a lot of respects, people were just saying, well, that's just the way they're done.
Right.
And that's the way it's always been done. So there was a little bit of tradition, a little bit of fear, and a lot of this came up as we started doing our business, and we're like, no, it doesn't have to be done that way. You know, why does a trade paperback have to be put out months and months and months and months, a year after the regular story? Let's come out a month or two after the story, see what happens. And we were doing a lot of these kind of things, just trying to break the business model and see what's working, what isn't working. And we found that so many of these ideas, like, again, I think if you would have pulled over, if you get into a time machine, if you and I can get into a time machine right now, and now we're back in 1964, right? And we're in Stan Lee's office, and we say, hey, Stan, guess what? In the year 2000, we're doing business exactly the same way you're doing it now. Isn't that great? And Stan's going to go, what's wrong with you guys? Are you crazy? 2000? That's like, how many years is that? You're still doing business like I'm doing? What, nothing's changed? You know what I mean? And he'd slap us, most likely. Okay, so put yourselves in our position now. We're sitting here looking around going, wow, this is weird. I mean, we're still color-coding comics. We're not doing and that was, again, Marvel Knights. We were doing computer coding. We were handing Marvel, in 1998, we handed Marvel a comic on disc. They looked at us and said, what do we do with this? Okay, so we had an inherent problem. And those were a lot of the things that we decided that, you know what, the question that we have to constantly ask ourselves is why. So we're going to reveal the origin of Wolverine. This is a big kind of story. We're going to reveal the origin of Wolverine.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately, when we said this to our editorial crew, three-quarters of the staff bristled. And by the way, I bristled a little bit too.
Sure.
And then Bill asked me, why are you bristling? And I said, because if you tell the origin of Wolverine, you will destroy the character. He won't be interesting anymore. And he's like, that's not true. And then we adjourned the meeting for lunch at that point. And I was sitting there in the corner. I was thinking about this. And I'm like, why did I say that? And then I remember the reason I said that it would destroy the character is because I remember hearing an editor at Marvel at one point say that. mm-hmm. never once questioning, is that true? Or is it just something people have said and keep saying and keep saying? Because somebody, when somebody said it, they might have had a valid reason for it.
Sure.
But now we don't question anymore because it's just being said. Well, that's just the way it's done. You just can't do that. And I went back to Bill and I was like, you know, I just thought about it. And I just said that because that's what I heard. But when I think about it, I don't know if that's really true. So we came back to the meeting and we started asking people, well, why can't we? And why can't we? Well, it's going to destroy the character. Why? And eventually, if you ask why enough times, you will, you know, it's kind of like the little kid that goes, why, why,
yeah.
why? But if you, and eventually your kid will get to you, you know, why are clouds white? Well, because they're full of, why? And then you go, I don't know, you know? And if you're a scientist, you can actually get to the reason. But if you're just a plain old dad like me, you're going to go, hey, I don't know, it's just white. So in the case of story ideas, if you ask why long enough, you will either get to a reason where somebody says, because X, Y, and Z, and you go, oh, okay, I get it. And then you walk away. Or you get to the point where they go, I don't know. And once you get to that point, you know, oh, okay, then this is just something that we've been saying because that's just something we've been saying, and it's time to move on and try to figure out maybe this is a story we can tell. And then again, when you're ready to tell that story, you better make sure it's a good one. Because if it's not a good one, then you do hurt the character.
Why becomes why not?
Yes.
Very appropriate for the House of Ideas.
Exactly. And or our latest phrase, which is, what would Stan do?
Very cool, man. Wow, you got the do you have the WWSD badges made up? I think that's great.
No, we don't, but I should coin the phrase, although I think Stan would take umbrage.
Or demand a royalty.
Yeah. Joey, what is this? What would Stan do?
Who else do you imitate, Joe?
Oh, I do a good Stan.
You do a fine Stan. That's very. I've broken into Stan several times on my own podcast.
True. Love that guy.
Oh, absolutely. He's the man. Well, yeah. He is the man. And now you're the man, Joe. Congratulations on 6 years.
I just keep the seat warm for the next person that comes over. There's only one man. That was Stan. Speaking of which, I'm gonna plug here. Can I plug?
By all means, yes.
December 2nd at UCLA, the Student Theater, an evening with Stan Lee and myself, Marvel Then and Now, and we're going to be taking questions, discussing some cool comic stuff, telling some stories from back then and today, comparing notes. And maybe we'll even talk about Peter Parker and that marriage of his. I don't know. Depends. But you know, it's also for a good cause. It's for the Hero Initiative, which used to be ACTOR.
Very cool.
And we'll be raising some money for artists that are much in need. And really hope that everybody comes down to support us. And, you know, just stay tuned. There's going to be some more announcements. I think there's going to be an after party and a pre-signing and all sorts of crazy stuff. And, you know, every dime of it goes to the charity.
Any other Cup of Joe announcements you'd like to make?
No, nothing off the top of my head right now.
Okay.
It's been a long day already, and I'm going to the Mets game, but it's pouring rain, so it doesn't look like it's going
to
happen.
I'm sorry to hear that, man.
What are you gonna do?
Joe, I appreciate your time.
John, thank you.
Thanks a lot for coming on today.
Really appreciate it, man.
Marvel Editor-in-Chief, Joe Quesada. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks a lot for listening. This is John Suntress. Thanks again for being so patient with some of the delays on new episodes. Lots of great guests are on the way. If you haven't checked out who's coming up, just check out our front page at wordballoon.com. You'll see it's worth the wait. Also, if you ever have any questions or suggestions for the show, I'm available at john@wordballoon.com. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2006.